There we go.
Of course, the
Now
idea
I
of
can
living
screen
beyond that is
share.
probably not our. I mean, it's just looking at it, putting the
Okay. Can y'all
business
see the
office on the farm.
presentation?
Yes.
All right, thank God.
Okay.
I don't see it for whatever that's worth.
I see it.
Are you
Yeah. See
visible?
it too.
I'm screen
Yeah, I
sharing.
see it as well.
Okay, good. Okay. All right, then we're gonna get started and
I see it now.
Guy's gonna start talking.
All right, so I don't want to face that way.
That's fine.
So I'm
That's
going to have to
fine.
turn that this
That's
way.
fine. And if
Okay.
you need a pointer or something, you can use this to
I
point.
forgot to bring my laser pointer.
That's
Okay.
fine. And you don't need to look at this or anything. Just project so they can,
Project, like as if I was a teacher, right?
as if you were still a teacher, and so the back of the classroom can hear you.
Okay. All right, so welcome everybody. This is the December 2025 meeting of the National Capital Astronomers. And so our agenda there, you can read, welcome it, and we got some announcements about the Lending Library.
All right, yeah, why don't you talk into this more than,
All
because
right.
we can see that, and that way you can look at
Yeah,
that.
all right. I'm going to have to sit down now.
That's fine.
All right. And some news about the Rock Creek Golf Course developments. And sidewalk astronomy and other stuff. And we'll have a talk by Dr. Sotsen. How do you say your last name? Sotsen. Okay. All right. And on the dragonfly. And probably no observing tonight after the meeting. No way. Okay. Let's see. How do we get it to go to the next slide?
Hit probably the down
I
button.
did.
Thanks. Oh.
Okay, that's it.
That's it?
That's it.
Okay.
So what?
Usually it should be the down or
Yeah,
the left
that's why I
button.
try.
Yeah.
Okay, so we do have a website, as you probably know, and we also have a Facebook page, and I've been trying to keep that up. If anybody wants to take that on, let me know. This is about the this is our telescope lending library. We've got telescopes from 4 inches refractors up to a 12-inch mede. I've got one of these, two of these in my basement. One is a Jones Bird, which is probably pretty poor optics, the 4.6 Celestron. But the other ones all have seem to have pretty good optics to them. And this 8-inch mede Schmidt-Cassegrain has got, sorry, the Celestron. It's got a modern Newtonian, good optics on a computerized mount. And you've used that mount, right, Gael?
Yeah.
And it's good, right?
Pretty good, yeah.
Okay. All right. So,
Guy,
yes.
is that list posted any place?
Not yet.
I was going to suggest we can post it to the website, create a page for it,
Okay.
and then, but we'll have to figure out how we want to do the contact or who to contact, or so that you don't get overwhelmed or something, along with some basic rules, like they have to be members. Some minimum of time, because we don't want people just joining and then trying to get access to the telescopes, and they're just joining and we don't know who they are, kind of. Yeah.
That's the main thing, they have to bring them back.
Yeah.
Right.
So having, posting some rules and things like that.
Right.
So we can talk about that offline, but yeah.
Yeah. Those are all things that definitely have to be worked out.
Yeah.
Jay, did you want to say anything about exploring the sky?
I have made up the schedule for next year, and I'll send a copy to Elizabeth and also to the people at the Rock Creek Nature Center so they can make up the forms so that we'll be allowed to use the facilities there.
Okay, thank you. And the last one we had, that was in November, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, theoretically.
Was that one canceled by weather too?
Yeah, the weather was
Yeah,
not good.
How many did we actually have this year that we didn't have? It wasn't very many.
No, we didn't. No.
It was terrible. Okay. And Gael Gomez of the Mount Pleasant Sidewalk Astronomers, which is essentially a subset of National Capital Astronomers. You want to say a few words?
Well, Mount Pleasant Sidewalk Astronomers has been pretty successful lately. We've got a lot more people interested. We talked with Brian Ralph. What's his name from Explore Scientific? We talked with them to see if we can come up with a design for a 5-inch Newtonian telescope that can be manufactured as a lightweight telescope design for limited edition. See if that actually goes anywhere. Scott Roberts, that's his name. Scott Roberts, holy crap. Mm-hmm. It's been going pretty awesome. We've managed to raise quite a bit of money now. We've almost gotten to our $10,000 milestone now.
Explain what that's about.
Say?
Explain what that's about.
Basically, it's to be able to pay my lawyer so I can stay in the country because of immigration troubles that we've had. It's complicated. Basically, temporary status was revoked for Venezuelans in November, and included in that is unfortunately myself. And so, yeah, we're basically having to pay for a new visa or have to leave the country.
All right. Yeah, I will second that. The events at the Mount Pleasant and Irving Streets Northwest in D.C. are very popular. People, you know, come down and they bring their kids, they bring their friends, and they sign up for the mailing list to be notified of when they're going to be coming. People will drive by and go park their car and then come on over and take a look. It's really neat.
How do you advertise yourself? Is it just word of mouth in the neighborhood?
For now, yeah, pretty much. We've gotten articles on 51st News, on WTOP, on NPR. I'm working on posters to post around the neighborhood as well. We're trying to see if we can work with the Bancroft Elementary School in Mount Pleasant as well. That's some of the ways that we're trying to get the word out, basically.
Good. Okay. And we still need an assistant secretary treasurer. Brian Tomich has moved out of the area. Anybody here want to take that on? Okay. All right. Well, I think I have a candidate. If you haven't joined our listserv, that's how you do it. Just send them an email to capitalastronomers+subscribe@groups.io. And I don't know if you've certainly heard about Trump administration moves on immigration, but did you know that he also wants to take on golf courses in D.C.? Just heard that today, believe it or not. And the reason it matters to us is this is where we do the Exploring Scholar, basically right there. And right over here, 1,700 yards away, is the Rock Creek Golf Course. I don't know if you can see that. Yeah, I think you can see that. The clubhouse. And they were talking about putting in a driving range. And if Trump does take it over, I'm sure he will put in a really, really the brightest driving range or something like that. And right now, this is the one of the other golf courses, and they're already dumping soil from the east wing of the White House. This is today. I heard about this. So I don't know what's going to happen, but keep your eyes open. There's
is
some
military road in the middle. Yes.
Yes. Yes. And up here, that's St. John's High School. This is, you know, Rock Creek Park. Oopsie. So our next meeting is January 10th. That's going to be Christine Hurst Bernhardt of the National Science Teachers Association.
And it will be online only.
Oh, is that right?
It will be online only.
Online only. All right.
Because I will not be here to open up the facility.
Okay.
I've been telling this to Brian, so hopefully he's let her know as well.
Okay. Thank you. All right. And because of the holidays, there's not going to be any telescope making modification maintenance workshop on those two dates. Just that's Friday, December 26th, my bad, or January 2. And Exploring the Sky resumes in April. And before we, any other announcements, anything that anybody wants to announce? All right. I bet this is your high school picture.
Shortly thereafter.
Okay. So I'm going to attempt my best to introduce her. It's my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Dr. Kristen S. Sotson, a research scientist at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory. She's both a space systems engineer and a planetary scientist. She's currently serving as the instrument scientist and systems engineer for the Dragonfly Geophysics and Meteorology Package, and that's part of NASA's ambitious Dragonfly mission to Saturn's moon Titan. I hope I'm not making too many mistakes here. She's also deeply engaged in exoplanet science. She leads NASA's Estimating Exoplanet Population Demographics and Planetary Infrared Excess Program, contributes to several James Webb Space Telescope exoplanet observing projects, and is a co-investigator on NASA's Strange New Worlds Initiative. Research focuses on unraveling the mysteries of exoplanet atmospheres through transmission and emission spectroscopy. She earned her PhD in Earth and Planetary Sciences from Johns Hopkins, following degrees in Engineering Physics from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, and Applied Physics from Johns Hopkins. Please help me to welcome Dr. Kristen Sotson, whose work is helping us better understand worlds both within our solar system and far beyond.
One moment as we transfer screen sharing. Okay, now what kind of connection do you have? I have these three cables.
Sorry, I'm missing something.
Because we're going to have to, we still have to plug you in for the projector. As well as in your sharing array, which is
okay,
good.
And then
I'm guessing this one.
This one should work.
If you need a pointer, here's a pointer.
Okay, thank you.
Laser part doesn't work. Why isn't it shut?
Extend my screen or something. It wants to do something.
Yeah.
Okay.
Awesome.
Okay. So do this. Does that work? Okay.
And what you're going to want to do is somehow we've got that. So at the, if you, at the, there's a way of duplicating. There we go.
So
That's perfect.
Okay, everybody's seeing the same thing?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Yes. And what we can do on your screen is I'll minimize this because you don't need to see the people.
Okay, thank you for the introduction. Thank you all for coming on this refreshing December evening. So I am Kristen Sotson from the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab over in Laurel. And so today I'm going to talk about my favorite planetary mission, Dragonfly. So already did a great intro. I will just for some additional background for me, I did cut my teeth in aerospace on the Space Shuttle Orbiter with Boeing, which was awesome, not gonna lie. Have since worked largely in space systems analysis and concept development at APL, including on Europa Clipper and obviously Dragonfly. And then the exoplanet research, both observing and theory projects. And I have also worked as a coach for Zero G. Okay, here we go. I just have to click physically. So I am the one up here talking about Dragonfly tonight, but I would really like to point out that it is a large team of people that is executing this mission and making it happen. So I promise I am in here. It took me a couple of minutes to find me, so I'll save you the trouble. I'm that one. I do want to give also a shout out to our PI, Dr. Elizabeth Turtle, who is our fearless leader and pretty much about the most amazing PI I could ever ask to work with. So we have a large team from various organizations across the country and even some contributions from JAXA over in Japan and some of our European partners. So we have broad representation of NASA centers, national labs, universities, industry, and international partners on this mission. Quick mission overview. Dragonfly is the fourth mission in NASA's New Frontiers program, selected in 2019. It is a relocatable rotorcraft lander mission, and it will be the first rotorcraft mission to carry its full science payload with it to different locations via flight. So Ingenuity was awesome, but it can't say that. So Dragonfly will investigate the surface composition of the materials on Titan's surface at different sites in different geologic settings. And it will also take measurements and images during our relocation flights. So fundamentally, Dragonfly will return images and data for a world that we have really only truly glimpsed once. Saturn's largest moon, Titan. Titan is the second largest moon in the solar system, right behind Ganymede. It has a gravity, surface gravity, 1/7 that of Earth's, and a little bit less than our moon. And it has a surface temperature of 94 Kelvin or minus 179 degrees Celsius. So I know it feels really cold outside right now, but I promise Titan is much colder. It also has a surface pressure of 1.5 bars, so half again the surface pressure that we feel on Earth's surface right now. And that high surface pressure with that cold temperature means that the atmospheric density is 4 times higher than the density that we experience at Earth's surface. So low gravity, high atmospheric density, sounds like a good combination for flight. The atmosphere is mostly nitrogen with a few percent methane, a little bit of hydrogen. Saturn and Titan are range from 8 to 11 astronomical units from Earth, an astronomical unit being the distance from the Earth to the Sun. So it has a one-way light travel time of 70 to 90 minutes. So Dragonfly is going to have to do most of its operations autonomously. We will be able to control very little directly. Like we expect for other icy moons in their solar system, we think that Titan has a subsurface liquid water ocean that through a couple of different mechanisms may have been exposed to the surface. So you might be thinking, Titan sounds really cold and inhospitable. Why are we sending a NASA mission there? But we don't actually know how life arose on Earth, and we can't go back and study the prebiotic processes that led to life on Earth because of the tectonic and erosional processes that Earth has. So we need to look to other places in our solar system to provide pieces to that puzzle of how chemistry became prebiotic chemistry, became biological chemistry. And Titan, perhaps a bit counterintuitively, is actually one of the places in the solar system that is the most like the early Earth and could hold the key to understanding our own chemical origins. It is the only moon that we know of, like at all, with a substantial atmosphere. The atmosphere was first suggested by José Solá in 1908, and then Gerard Kuiper in the 1940s achieved a spectroscopic detection of methane. So around the 1940s, we knew that it had some kind of atmosphere, but we didn't know very much about it until later. As I mentioned, as with other icy moons in the solar system, and based on Cassini data and interior models, we expect Titan to have a liquid water ocean beneath the surface. There are still a lot of open questions about that, of how deep that ocean it is, how far below the surface it is, how accessible that water might have been to the surface through some different mechanisms. But fundamentally, we do think that there is liquid water on Titan that may have been exposed to the surface at one point. I mentioned that Titan has a few percent methane in its atmosphere, which it actually makes Titan one of the most interesting places in the solar system, because when that methane is exposed to the energetic photons and particles coming from the sun and from Saturn, there's a lot of photochemistry that happens that produces complex carbon molecules. So these molecules form and aggregate in the upper atmosphere and then drift down through the surface and then cover the surface in a layer of rich organic material. So between those organic compounds coming down from the atmosphere and the water that we think may have been exposed to the surface from the subsurface liquid ocean, there is a potential on Titan for organic compounds to have mixed with liquid water, potentially for extended periods, in the past. So Titan is a singular destination for understanding the chemical processes on our own planet that supported the development of life. Saturn and Titan take 29 and a half Earth years to complete one orbit. And Saturn's axial tilt is 26.7 degrees, which is really similar to Earth's 23 and a half degree tilt. So Saturn, and therefore Titan, have seasons, similar to Earth, has a winter, spring, summer, fall. And you may notice from this table that we are actually pretty much in the fall equinox for Titan, which is why the rings are edge on if you've been observing Saturn. So we expect to see, and we have observed, weather on Titan due to those changing seasons. Because Titan is tidally locked with Saturn, it rotates around its axis at the same rate that it rotates around Saturn. So its day is 16 Earth days long. Scientists have studied Titan remotely using the Hubble Space Telescope, ground-based telescopes like Keck, and more recently with JWST. And those data are helpful. We can get some information from them, but as you can see from these images, they're obviously because of the distance to Saturn and that dense atmosphere that makes we have very specific wavelengths that we can see down to the surface. The resolution from this distance is very low. So we can get we can do some cloud tracking and we can get some contrast information about the surface. But to get, obviously to get more detailed information, we really need to go visit, which we have done previously a bit. Pioneer 11 went in 1979, followed closely by Voyagers 1 and 2. And then the Cassini mission was NASA's mission, NASA and ESA, to study the Saturnian system. Saturn itself, the rings, the moons, and it had multiple Titan flybys from which we got a lot of remote imaging, remote data. And then, of course, it also released the Huygens probe in early 2005, which successfully landed on the surface and operated brilliantly, but for about 4 hours. And then Dragonfly will arrive in the mid-2030s. Here you can see the Cassini spacecraft with the Huygens probe on the side there. And then you can see, you can get a sense for the scale from the two technicians that are integrating the Huygens probe on the side. So it's a substantial spacecraft.
Was the 4 hour lifetime due to a malfunction or was it by design?
No, no, that's just the amount of battery it had to operate everything. So before Cassini and Huygens, this kind of image was essentially what we had of Titan. Just a very opaque atmosphere, kind of an orangey yellow ball. But Cassini carried multiple instruments that were specifically designed to peer through that through the methane bands in that atmosphere in those wavelength windows, so that we can get more detailed data about the surface. So here we have a map from Cassini of Titan in the near infrared wavelengths, and you can see some features, right? We have a couple of impact craters and then these darker regions along the equator, and then of course the lakes and seas in the north.
So the white stuff, is that mostly clouds or is that?
I think some of it's clouds and then some of it is just probably material that we didn't get much signature back from. Cassini did have a synthetic aperture radar or SAR, which gave us some more data about Titan's terrain and a bit of topography, though Titan is actually overall quite flat. So again, you can see, we see those impact craters that kind of pop out maybe a little bit more. And then there are some other features that I'll go into in a minute. Cassini did also carry the visual and infrared mapping spectrometer that was able to take some spectral data of Titan in some specific wave bands. So, basically what we see here is we have some kind of broad categories of the surface materials on Titan. The bluer regions have a signature consistent with water ice. So we think that those are areas of exposed water ice. And then the kind of brownish regions have a signature consistent with organics. So looking at an enhanced color map, we have those impact craters with the exposed water ice, and then this like belt of organic material that covers much of the equatorial regions. And so Dragonfly will explore around Selk crater, which is that one kind of in the middle. And Selk crater is of interest for, is of particular interest for a couple of reasons. One, it's an impact crater, so it's a place where we think that between the melting of the crust at the impact and then possibly also water coming up from the subsurface ocean, there may have been an extended period where that water and organics could have mixed. But if we look at the area just south of Salt Crater, you see this structure, these structures that look like dunes, sand dunes. And we see these all across most of that organic material, that brown belt across the equator, actually takes the structure of dunes. Now, what this image doesn't give us a good sense for is the scale of these dunes. These are massive. These dunes are very similar in morphology to the sand dunes in the Namibian Sand Sea over in Africa, which are about 100 meters high and 1.5 to 2 kilometers crest to crest. So this image, this photograph was taken at the crest of one dune, and I wish on Titan, but it was actually Namibia, and looking out across to the next dune. And the little tiny black speck in the middle of that yellow square that looks very much like the other specks is a pickup truck, which is about the same size that Dragonfly is. So this just helps give a little bit more sense of scale of the distances that Dragonfly will be covering between each flight, since we want to go between the interdune areas for each flight, working our way up to Selk, and also the kind of distance that we'll be covering over the course of the mission. Excuse me. We also, in the SAR data, see what look like tectonic structures on Titan, essentially fault lines. So again, potentially areas where that liquid water may have come up and been exposed on the surface. And we see a couple of places where we have these kind of like mountain and valley structures that may be indications of past cryovolcanism, so that essentially water forcing its way up from the subsurface onto the surface, similar to the way that magma forces its way up through volcanoes. I mentioned that Titan has seasons. So Titan is, we tend to think of most moons as dead or inactive worlds, but with its atmosphere and its seasons, Titan is a living, dynamic moon. And one of the things that we've been able to observe is cloud changes and weather patterns. And Titan actually has a methane cycle akin to Earth's water cycle, where methane evaporates from the surface, condenses as clouds, and then precipitates back down to the surface as essentially rain. This slide is always a little finicky. There we go. And another feature that we see on Titan is these dendritic networks that highly resemble river channels. So we think these formed in a similar method that river channels do on Earth, where precipitation fell out of the atmosphere and flowed as liquid and eroded the surrounding material to form these channels. And then, of course, we have the lakes and seas in the polar regions that are fairly well known for Titan. Now, Huygens already visited Titan, right? So why do we need to go back? Well, Huygens operated for only a few hours because it wasn't designed to operate for much longer than that. And it only visited one place on Titan. So we have really only a snapshot of a single place at a single point in time on Titan. And we now know from the Cassini data that this is a very dynamic world with a variety of environments. So we really want to explore more than one location. So Titan or Dragonfly is at least partially an astrobiological mission. And we now know that Titan has the key ingredients that we consider to be necessary for life as we know it. We have energy coming from the sunlight. We have this abundant organic material that formed in the atmosphere and then drifted down to the surface. And we have two liquids. We have methane, that's part of that active methane cycle, and water that we think was exposed to the surface in the past. So on Titan, we can study prebiotic chemistry in the context of a planetary environment with Earth-like surface processes. So Cassini showed us that Titan has these diverse surface materials and environments, an Earth-like variety of geologic and surface processes. And we know that, okay, so we know that we want to go to multiple locations on Titan. But the challenge is to get our science instruments to multiple sites to sample materials and take geological data in multiple locations. So again, with that dense atmosphere and that low gravity, heavier than air mobility is highly efficient on Titan, hence the rotorcraft design. Dragonfly includes several mission elements. We have our spacecraft, which includes our crew stage and our entry vehicle, the entry vehicle comprising our heat shield and back shell, and then the lander itself. So that lander will transport the entire science payload and do surface and aerial measurements. We can take measurements during our relocation flights. We have direct to Earth. We can't afford an orbiter on a New Frontiers mission. So we have direct to Earth communication via our high gain antenna, which you can see deployed there. And our primary power source is a multi-mission thermoelectric generator, or MMRTG. But the conversion efficiency of the MMRTG from heat to electricity is very low. So we can't power anything off of the MMRTG directly. So we use the MMRTG to power, to charge a battery. And we do essentially all of our operations off of that battery.
Are you using the Deep Space Network for downlink?
Yes.
Schedule it a couple of times a day?
I think it's once or twice a day, depending on the mission phase, I think.
I'm curious what the data rate is, and especially how would that compare to your atmosphere over Mars? Like, it's farther
out. Low. It's low. That's actually one of our most constrained resources is our data rate. So we have to be very cognizant in our operations design of what data we're collecting when and how we're gonna send it back. So it's a great question. Dragonfly on Titan, we're looking to address three fundamental questions about astrobiology. What makes a world habitable? For which Dragonfly will investigate that methane cycle, geologic processes, and opportunities for liquid and organic mixing. The chemical processes that led to the development of life, for which Dragonfly will inventory the complex carbon-rich materials and chemistry on Titan surface. And then whether life has developed elsewhere in our solar system. And so Dragonfly will be making measurements that allow for a contextualized search for potential chemical biosignatures. Okay, how do we address these questions? So we have a science payload that consists of four science instruments. We have our mass spectrometer, which is fed material by DRAMS is our mass spectrometer, which is fed material by
our drill, Draco. We also have a gamma ray neutron spectrometer, Dragons. And then the geophysics and meteorology instrument, or DragMet, will do the seismic monitoring and the weather monitoring. So that's the instrument that I mostly work on. And then we have our camera suite to take images of the surrounding environment and geology, as well as the more focused images of the sample area where the drill will be operating. So DRAMS has been designed to conduct a comprehensive study of the molecular complexity and diversity of Titan's surface material. So it will analyze those chemical compounds and processes that produce biologically relevant compounds. We have two modes to do this. We have our laser desorption mode, which provides a broad survey and structural analysis of the regolith molecules. And then we have our gas chromatography mode, which provides definitive molecular detection, as well as detection of chirality, which most life on Earth favors one chirality of organic molecules over another. So a chirality imbalance is an indication of prebiotic or biological activity. So DRAMS only has 40 sample cups that it can use. So it is essentially a constrained resource. So we may not sample at every site if a given site doesn't look sufficiently different from where we've been before, or doesn't look very interesting for some reason. Our gamma ray neutron spectrometer, however, we can take all the data we want because it doesn't have a constrained expendable like that, those sample cups. So Dragons provides a more broad classification of the surface materials and the local subsurface at each site. So it can give us that bulk elemental surface composition by which we can kind of categorize the surface materials. It will also allow us to detect the minor inorganic elements in the subsurface and reveal the near surface stratigraphy, so we get a sense of any layering that might be going on there. DragMet is an instrument that consists of 12 different types of sensors, most of which we have more than one unit. So I think it's 29 sensors altogether. So this is what happens when you let a scientist say, well, just one more. We have our meteorological sensors, temperature, pressure, methane humidity, hydrogen, and wind speed and direction. And then we have sensors on the skids that will provide measurements of the thermal response, which gives us a sense for the dampness and porosity of the regolith directly under the skids, as well as the dielectric constant, which allows us to kind of broadly categorize that material right under the skids.
The data from DragMet, I would assume, is also going to be used to actually get the conditions to determine whether if a flight is actually possible or not, I would imagine, right?
Yes, we do not provide any decisions to the lander, but we provide an indication to the lander of whether the wind exceeds a certain threshold above which we would not want to fly. The wind sensors actually can also be used as rain detection, because we also don't want to fly if it's raining. Essentially Dragonfly or DragMet will provide the lander information about whether we think it's safe to fly.
And kind of associated to the same question as well, but how bad is the weather in Titan? not sure if it's relevant.
So for a mission, especially one that we have, that we can barely control remotely, let alone fix anything, right? Everything is designed to like the worst case. overall, we expect the, and that's one reason why we want to land in the mid 2030s, so that we're in roughly the same season that Huygens landed on back in 2005. But we actually expect the conditions to be fairly mild, pretty low wind speeds, I think average of 2 meters per second or less. We don't expect there to be any rain. We have to plan for it, but so we don't anticipate the weather being an issue for the lander or a hindrance to our flight operations. And so then the last category of sensors on DragMet, we have a pair of electric field antennas that we can use to look for a couple of different signals, but one of which being the Schumann resonance, which we might be able to use to constrain the depth to that subsurface ocean. And then we have two sets of geophones and a seismometer that will monitor the geologic activity so that we can characterize the interior structure and activity for Titan. And then DragonCam has multiple pairs of science cameras. We have some forward cameras looking out, some down cameras looking right underneath the lander. We have what we call the microscopic camera, which is very focused on that drill, that area where the drill is going to be operating. And then we have some cameras looking kind of out the sides. Dragon Cam also is carrying a set of LEDs that we can use to illuminate at different times in different wavelengths, including a UV light that we can, for which we can look for fluorescence from aromatic compounds and PAHs, since those are stimulated by UV. So this is a CAD model of the lander interior. You can see the MMRTG, and that there is the drill. And then that's the aluminum bulkhead that will go around and encompass everything. And then this is essentially our flight infrastructure and our antenna. And then that's the foam that will go around the whole lander. And all of that gets packaged into our aeroshell and then on our crew stage.
And that's about the size of a pickup truck, you said?
The lander itself is about the size of a pickup truck.
So this is more like the size of a pickup truck?
Smaller than this room, but...
About the size of that telescope, maybe?
Oh, you mean this whole thing?
No, yeah, no. That whole thing is like...
I mean, that whole thing goes like in a Falcon Heavy fairing, so...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So yeah,
my scale was completely wrong.
okay.
The big top of the surface.
I actually. Oh, oops. Oh, weird. I don't actually remember. Sorry. That's all part of like the crew stage, which is kind of out of my bailiwick.
So you mentioned chirality. Do you expect to be able to find amino acids?
We should be able to differentiate amino acids, sugars, again, chirality.
Measure their chirality.
Yes, and measure the chirality. Yeah.
In analyzing your data, will you guys be able to analyze it throughout the mission, or is it something that you have to wait until the rover returns in order to analyze the data?
Well, it's not returning. It's staying there. We have no mechanism for getting it back. The nice thing about the Titan day being 16 Earth days is, so one Earth month is essentially two Titan days. And so we'll plan on flying about once a month. And we can only get data back during the Titan day, because we need direct to Earth communication. So, and that's when the Selk crater is, well, yeah, we can, it's only, it, the day side of Titan is the one that's pointed toward the sun, therefore toward us. Mm-hmm. So we'll get our data back. But the nice thing is that we have that whole Titan night, which is like a whole week, to look at the data we're getting back, plan our next set of operations, our flights, etc. So the timelines are a little more like human friendly than the Mars timelines, where Mars has, you know, a what, like 27-hour day or something. So it's people working on Mars missions are always up at like weird hours because they're trying to analyze the data and plan the next day's operations as quickly as possible.
You're up like a set of operations that mm-hmm. span several hours or days or something.
I think we'll basically upload the operations set for at least the first chunk of the Titan day. Because there will be overlap between when we are awake and able to do science and engineering things and the that next Titan day.
Yeah.
So we don't have to do like everything in the Titan night. We'll have time during the Titan day too. Mm-hmm. So
the operations that took off automatically, autonomously.
Yes. Yes. So, but there are certain decisions that are timed in the Titan day such that if we want a ground in the loop like decision, like we will make a close to flight decision, like close to time of flight decision about whether we are going to fly based on the like ambient yes. weather conditions at the time. Right. So
the 32-day is the rotation of Titan.
Mm-hmm.
How?
But it's 16 days.
Pardon?
It's 16 days. One Titan day is 16 Earth days. So we get two Titan days in a month.
You mean the whole day?
Yes, yes.
And then there's 16 night days.
No, there's eight day days and then eight night days.
Okay,
yeah.
So every month is 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
And how long does it take to go around Saturn?
It's the same because it's tidally locked.
Oh, it's tidally locked. Okay.
So yeah. I was going to ask, since it is tidally locked, are you going to be planning to put the copter on the Saturn facing side or the side facing away from Saturn?
It'll be the side facing away from Saturn because the side that is facing Saturn, because we need to be able to communicate with it directly. Yeah. So
you're landing on the back of the moon.
Right, we're landing on the back of the moon.
I would imagine it's actually somewhat closer to like in between the back side of Titan and the front side of Titan that's facing Saturn, because the side is that the side that will actually face the Earth during a specific part of its orbit.
It'll face us. Every 16 days, it'll do that, no matter which side it's on. I was just curious as to whether you thought perhaps that the planet itself would have such a magnetic system like Jupiter does that it would zap the instruments or something like that.
Titan, because Titan is pretty far from Saturn, or I forget the exact distance, but it's well outside Saturn's magnetic magnetic field. Okay, great questions, everybody. All right, so we are currently in what we call phase C of the NASA mission, which is, so we've passed our critical design review where the review team said, yay, verily, proceed with building your flight hardware. So we've been building flight hardware, starting doing our performance and testing and whatnot, and so we are rapidly approaching what we call phase D, where we start doing our integration, what we call INT, integration and test. So basically plugging everything together and making sure that everything talks to each other correctly. So in summer of 2028, we will launch on a SpaceX Falcon Heavy. And then we will do and then we will do one Earth flyby gravity assist before we head out to Saturn. And that will take us, we have a 6.5 year cruise phase. So we launch and then we go find something else to do for 6.5 years.
Is it a Mars flyby or an Earth flyby?
It is actually an Earth flyby. Okay. This diagram is a little misleading in that sense. So 6.5 year cruise, then we arrive at Titan, we do our entry, descent, and landing, and do our first autonomous landing on a world for which we do not have spectacular terrain data. I trust our mobility team a lot. So we'll do our first landing on the surface, do our all our commissioning activities, and then we have our vertical flight, and we'll do surface science for the first landing site. We'll be there for a while doing commissioning and surface science, and then we'll start our operations where we do our relocation flights, working our way over to Salt Crater. So our landing ellipse is there, kind of just south of the crater, and we wanted to land with kind of amongst the sand dunes for several reasons. One, we think it gives us the best, based on analogous sand dune and interdune areas on Earth, we think that the interdunes will provide the best probability for a safe landing site. And then also we know that the sand dunes consist of that organic material, so we would expect to experience that organic material in the interdunes. So Dragonfly's nominal mission is 3.3 years, which is more than 74 what we call T-SOLs, Titan days. So we'll explore more than 30 sites over the course of the mission. As I mentioned earlier, we plan on nominal flight schedule after commissioning, which is a longer time on the ground, is essentially once an Earth month, so every two T-SOLs. And the flights are only 30-ish minutes, so Dragonfly will spend the vast majority of its time on Titan surface doing science.
Do you have an idea how long the commission period will last?
That one is, I want to say, like 6 T-SOLs between commissioning and initial surface science. So,
is there any science you can start in the middle of the commission?
I mean, we're gonna start taking measurements with DragMet basically almost as soon as we land. So I'm not going to talk through this whole chart because it's a bit of an eye chart, but the key takeaways here are for our first flight, which our mobility team assures me will be very safe, we'll do a bit of some reconnaissance during the flight before we settle on an initial landing site. And then, as you can see, there's like various options for how we can relocate the lander that have all kinds of different names. Fundamentally, after that initial landing, and we'll have kind of scouted around for to take images of the surrounding area from which our operations and science teams will select the next landing site. And so from there, we can essentially do a jump flight where we relocate, or we can, if we say, maybe we need to do a little more reconnaissance, we can do a scout flight where it comes back to the same location. Or we can tell it, just go find somewhere, you know? I don't think we're gonna do that after the first landing.
Is there some limit to the length of the flight?
Battery life.
What about in terms of distance?
That depends a bit on the winds.
Yeah, sure.
So, which are going to be a little higher or a little faster at flight altitude. We're flying at, they keep lowering the maximum altitude. The last I heard, I think, was 400 meters. Okay. So it depends on the headwind. I forget what they are at altitude. They're still not terribly fast, but when you have a limited battery life, it matters.
Is there any way that that the battery could be recharged from materials on the surface?
I don't think so. There's not really the only like mechanism for getting any. We're actually trying very hard to keep surface materials out of the lander as much as possible, except for the drill putting materials into the mass spec cups.
With the 80-minute delay to get things back, you're not going to be watching how it decides where to land. I mean, that's
nope.
All autonomous now?
It's all autonomous.
Okay.
That's our. So Mars has the 7 minutes of terror or whatever it is. So we have. I have been assured by the mobility team that we have like 30 minutes of mild concern. Is what they've told me.
So what are you going to do during that period?
You're talking about
Hope.
The entry time, right?
Oh, no, the entry time is longer.
Like it's
the entry time is a couple of hours.
Yeah.
Depending on how you define, like entry is in like the atmosphere hits a certain density.
In
kind
Mars,
of entry.
The 7 minutes of terror is from
yeah, that's from
the
top to the surface. Yeah, no, the entry and initial landing will be a couple hours of mild concern.
For Titan. But it's almost a 2.5 hour circuit time. So if you saw something and you wanted to say, "Oh, go there," it would take 2.5 hours.
Yeah, we cannot direct it mid-flight during any
right.
part of the mission, even during EDL. So it has to make all its own decisions. Little bird has to fly from the nest and.
You can tell it next time do
yes.
this differently.
Yes, we can tell. We can, all the software and most of the software, I'm not going to say all because I'm not 100% sure, but most of the software is updatable, so we can tell it do this differently next time. Or if it lands, we can tell it, hey, go over there or go look around over there a little bit more or
right.
something like that. So. This slide. So lots of autonomy required for Dragonfly to be successful. So we have two navigation cameras. Those are those ones kind of on the front, the forward bottom. And we have an IMU, an inertial measurement unit, which is on the inside, so you can't see it here. And then we have a LIDAR for altitude. Estimation. So, as I've mentioned before, our best data for our landing site is still not particularly high resolution. So we need that really high level of autonomy to accommodate the uncertainty in the terrain and the topography, particularly for that first landing. So our mobility team has been very active since the beginning, and they've probably done the most testing of any other system, of any system on the lander. So they do their hardware and software development, and they have this integrated test platform that you can see here, which is half scale. Which they've been taking out to the Imperial Dunes in California, which are not quite the same structure as the dunes that we expect to see. But they've been doing a lot of testing out there to demonstrate the guidance and control algorithm, the navigation, and all the autonomous activities that the flight activities that the lander needs to be able to do. So I mentioned that we are like neck deep in hardware builds and subsystem instrument testing and performance validation and verification. We have been using multiple different test facilities to test the aerodynamics and the mobility development. We just actually finished up another test in the transonic dynamics tunnel, TDT, down at Langley, with I think it was a half scale model. So, and then you can also see the molds for the heat shield in the back shell on the upper right there.
Is there doing thermal testing?
Oh yeah.
You said 94 Kelvin?
94 Kelvin. Wow. That's a great segue. Thank you.
Oh,
APL actually has some of the most capable testing facilities and comprehensive testing facilities for spacecraft in the country. But even so, there has never really been a mission before that needed to test for cold and high pressure. And I remember calling our test facility lead in like 2019 or 20 and saying like, hey, can't we just throw things in the cold chamber and you know, crank up the pressure? And he was like, the seals don't work that way. I was like, right, the direction. So we had specially built our Titan pressure environment chamber, or what we call TPEC. And you can see there our setup for testing our wind sensors that swings them around. And then we also built what we're calling the Titan chamber. I think it's one of the biggest chambers that can go down to like Titan-like temperatures in the country. So we can fit the whole, so TPEC is only like, I think that thing doesn't, okay, so the ladder that's next to it, as you can see, that's like a three-step ladder. So TPEC itself is not huge. The Titan chamber, we can fit the whole lander minus the rotor arms and the rotors. So we can do our integrated cold and pressure environment testing in that chamber. And that's at APL. We do have a student and early career guest investigator program. Being such a long mission with such a long crew stage, and then a multi-year nominal mission after that, one of the things that our management has been cognizant of since the proposal has been bench depth for both expertise and career stage. So the guest investigator program is one of the kind of mechanisms that they have for maintaining that bench depth, bringing in new young career students and young career, and also just extending, providing opportunities to students to engage with mission scientists and engineers. So I think that's an application-based process. But if anybody knows anybody who might be interested, I can. Are you a student?
Yeah. Student of astronomy.
Okay, fair.
Not a physical, not in school.
I'm not directly involved in that, but I know the people who are. So. And we also try to be active in our outreach and engagement with the community, letting people know where their tax dollars are going and why, and also STEM activities in schools and universities to keep students at all ages engaged with NASA engineering and with space engineering and science. I'll say if there are any other communities that you think might be interested in hearing about Dragonfly, let us know. One thing that we do have on the website, the model is a little outdated, but it's still kind of fun to play around with, is a bit of an augmented reality model. So it's, you can go to dragonfly.jhuapl.edu, and if you poke around on there, you can find it. Or if you want, if y'all want to take a second and snap the QR code, do that.
Two questions. One, it's a practical one. How confident are you that the funding is going to hold up? One, and two, you have specific hypotheses that you're testing.
Specific hypotheses. Okay, so I'll, the first question.
Of any sort, composition, etc.
First question first. I mean, we have very strong support from NASA. So we don't at this point have, and even the presidential budget request in the spring had Dragonfly fully funded at the planned levels through launch. So we have no reason to believe at this point that they would try to decrease our funding. As far as the specific hypotheses, science hypotheses, I mean, that kind of goes into what I was talking about on the science side. We want to look for the potentially prebiotic molecules. And I mean, because Titan fundamentally we can think of Titan as a chemical and hopefully prebiotic chemistry laboratory that had at least millions, possibly billions of years for that chemistry to develop, and maybe got frozen on the surface in different stages where we might be able to say, oh, hey, look, this looks like it occurred, like we had step one of chemistry, and then step two, and then step three, beginning of prebiotic chemistry, et cetera. We do want to use the seismic data to investigate what we think that internal structure might be and whether we think there is a subsurface ocean and how deep it might be. Not just how far below the surface, but also how deep it goes down. Because that is actually debated. Based on the some models say one thing, other models say another thing. And we have a couple different, we can use the pressure data actually to look for signals as to how rigid the rigid Titan is as a structure, based on how much the pressure changes as we go around, and therefore how much the atmosphere is kind of pulled or pushed towards Saturn versus how flexible Titan itself is. I think the fundamental hypothesis of Dragonfly is, will we find any evidence of prebiotic chemistry that happened? So
what's the eccentricity of the orbit?
Pretty low. I don't remember what it is off the top of my head.
So you're not going to get a lot of stress and strain coming closer and farther from Saturn.
But there is, it's not a high eccentricity, but it's still there. Also, because we're at one location, right? So if the atmosphere is fundamentally pulled a little bit towards Saturn on the Saturn side, then when we rotate under that atmosphere, there's a bit of a lag in the atmospheric rotation with the surface, right? So we can rotate a bit under the atmosphere.
Moon creating gravity waves in this Saturn atmosphere?
No, it's the Titan atmosphere.
The Titan atmosphere.
Basically looking for any atmospheric tides,
but it's
as
locked.
We're.
Am I going to explore perfect tidal lock. It's kind of like the moon. The moon wobbles a little bit.
Well, and also there can be a lag between the atmospheric rotation and the surface rotation, yeah. Right?
I had a couple questions. You talk about sand dunes there, mm-hmm. And to me, sand is mostly silicon dioxide, quartz.
These are organic sands.
Okay.
We do not know how to form, to quote our RPI, we don't know how to form organic sands, but Titan does. Because that's what we see, those dune, that belt of organic, of material around the equator that has a signature consistent with organics, forms those sand dunes, or those dune-like structures.
Yeah, so I mean, they're calling it sand, but...
Yeah, it's not sand as you know it.
Okay, all right.
But we don't have a better word for it yet.
But we don't have a better word for it, exactly.
So I have a quick question. So given the testing of the instruments and everything and the payload and stuff, and that it is so different, so you've got the pressure and all that and the cold and whatnot, how about the methane rain? How... It's one thing to seal instruments against water, but methane has its own, doesn't it?
So, I mean, the lander is basic. So we have a requirement in our, we have lots of environmental requirements. And one of them basically is that anything that is on the lander exterior or exposed to the elements needs to not be, have any performance degradation due to the methane.
Okay.
Basically, we have anything that's outside has to be robust to methane.
How do you test that?
Yeah.
Spray it with kerosene and see what happens.
Yeah. Pour liquid methane on top of it. And
no, basically we have our materials and our assurance folks who look at all the materials in everything
sure.
that we're putting on the outside and say, yep, should be good.
Oh.
Okay.
I can do
that. So okay. Question, and what's the budget like for this project?
New Frontiers is, I think there's only so much I can say about this, but New Frontiers is nominally $1 billion for the mission before the launch vehicle.
Yeah.
Right. Due to a number of factors, mostly out of APL's control, COVID was a big impact. I don't know if y'all remember all the supply chain issues that caused, et cetera. I think it's going to be a little over three, all told.
Okay.
I think that includes, or I think it's pushing four with the launch vehicle, though.
Okay. Well, so it's around $4 to $5 billion in total.
It'll be under five.
Right. Sure. Because it's going to take how long to get out to Saturn?
6.5 years.
6 years. So yeah. Somebody has to keep watch over all this thing.
Right, right. We'll do check-ins
a couple times
a year to just make sure everything's okay.
So there has to be a mission control team.
Right.
Right. So around $5 billion, roughly.
Let's say four.
Four. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
And that, I mean, includes, that includes this, the
yeah.
phase E, the
yeah.
science phase, too.
Yeah. No, that's fine.
So.
A follow-up question.
How about two more questions?
Do you know what are the primary policy interests from NASA?
I'm sorry, what?
What are the primary policy interests from NASA?
I'm not quite sure I understand the question.
Like what is
the
policy side motivation
from NASA
for funding the Dragonfly?
Well, this
was
all.
I mean, Dragonfly was selected for the science that we want to do at Titan.
Mm-hmm.
So that was,
okay.
In the good old
to my knowledge,
when
we were selected.
Things are driven by science, not policy.
Okay, last question.
So I wondered, is Titan the best or only? Are there other candidates to study prebiotics, organics? And I just also was thinking that, you know, I always, when you think about You know, studying organics and other planets or worlds, I always think of planets. And I was wondering, is Moon something that we're thinking more and more about? Or, I mean, I guess is, it might just be hard to study. Do they tend, moons tend to have less atmospheres? Or a good reason we've been thinking of planets for like the drainage things and other things like that?
Well, now we can get into the exoplanet side, which is my other baby. So the first, there were a few things in the chat. I don't know if there were questions.
Complaining about microphone to pass around. What kind of wind speeds are there and how would that affect drone operations? How long do you expect Dragonfly to last? I think a lot of these probably got answered during the...
Over the course of...
Yeah.
So nothing like
nothing
groundbreaking.
Nothing groundbreaking, no.
Okay. So there are a couple other places that we think are promising, potentially. So I think everybody's familiar with Europa and, you know, the, like, Europa has active ice tectonics. So we know that there's water underneath. So Europa is a possibility. Enceladus is another one. There's the plumes coming out of the South Pole that have water and organics. And if it's the water's liquid, we can tell from the heat signature of the South Pole that the water's liquid. So that's another place. The results from a few weeks, months, time is an illusion, from Perseverance for on Mars, that was, again, interesting. So there are other places. A lot of the other, the moons are hard, especially for landing. Like landing on Europa is hard. And then we're interested in the water that's below the, I forget how many dozens of kilometers thick ice crust. So then you have to get down there and then somehow get data back. And then Enceladus is so small that it just takes, it's very interesting, but it's very hard to get to. It takes so much energy to get a spacecraft by Enceladus and at a speed where it can collect any samples and not just demolish them with the speed at which they're collected, right? So there certainly are other places, even in the solar system, that are interesting, but they are hard. I'm not the Titan's easy, but... and then, and as far as exoplanets, we don't really have any evidence yet of an exomoon, and it's going to be really hard to get any kind of like spectroscopic data back from an exomoon. Getting spectroscopic data back for a rocky planet around the smallest stars that there are is still hard. So I'm not saying it won't happen, but it's not low-hanging fruit. I'll put it that way.
That makes sense. It's hard to get the data, which makes sense, but it just seems like I've never heard someone even acknowledge that, you know, could be a possibility in terms of
people are talking about it. Okay. And maybe with the like next space telescopes after JWST, we might be able to have like the apertures to get enough signal to do an exomoon study. So people are talking about it. Okay. It is in the cognizance of the community.
Any questions? Let's give Dr. Seltzer.
Maybe get back to her question. I think, I know that policy is kind of the word that you want to use, but NASA and a lot of other organizations have always been more science driven, and that one of the science goals that this is addressing probably came out of one of the decadal surveys, mm-hmm. or the decadal things that they do every decade, and so this is probably addressing one of those suggestions of we want to learn about. And so this is in response to that. And then, you know, NASA some many years ago put out the New Horizons, you know, call for projects. And this was one of
New Frontiers.
New Frontiers.
New Horizons was the Pluto spacecraft.
I know.
Also, APL. Thank you for the pitch.
I know. New Frontiers, class of missions and everything. And y'all are one of three in the, wasn't it one of three that got selected for like the Phase B or whatever?
You mean Dragonfly?
Yeah.
Dragonfly and CSER, the Comet Sample Return Mission, were the two that were selected for the Phase A study in 2017. Yes.
Yeah.
They did the down select to the two in 2017 and then did, so we did the Phase A, did all the reviews and everything, and then did the formal down select to Dragonfly in 2019. And it was I forget when it came out, if it was maybe 2014, the New Frontiers call.
Right.
Added, Ocean Worlds as a destination, as a New Frontiers destination.
And so this has been like in a long development already, and that's how a lot of these missions usually are. That there is, there's a lot of phases that have already happened to even get to this build phase.
Well, and most, we'll call it like New Frontiers and flagship missions do not get. Well, flagship, I guess, is assigned by NASA, so that's different. But it's pretty rare for a NASA mission, especially one of like Discovery or New Frontiers class, to be selected on the first go. Most missions have had proposals in for multiple rounds before they're finally selected. So Dragonfly kind of surprised everybody when we put it in 2017 as our first go, and NASA said, yes, that one.
I think Chopper was part of that initial one too, wasn't it?
Chopper was, I forget which category that was. It wasn't Discovery, was it?
It may have been Discovery.
It was probably Discovery.
Yeah, because it was a smaller, very focused.
Yeah, because New Horizons was the first New Frontiers
New Horizons,
mission.
New Frontiers, yeah.
That's
why I always get it mixed up, because it was.
Yeah. I have to stop and think about it for a second. That is what drives most of the mission selection process. So.
And like New Frontiers, so there's different classes of missions. There's Discovery class, which are usually less expensive.
It's
very, very focused.
$300 million.
Very, very focused projects, usually very fast turnaround kind of thing. Then you have these New Frontiers, and then you have like flagship missions, which was like Cassini, which are
Europa Clipper. It was the most recent flagship.
And so the flagship is going to be really, really expensive, really long duration. The New Frontiers is kind of that in between with the Discovery at the very fast turnaround kind of thing. So. I only know that because I worked on Deep Impact back in the day. Long time ago.
Nice.
And then, adding to what Elizabeth was just saying, NASA puts a very great amount of weight on the results of the decadal surveys.
Yes.
Days, which basically, if you're not familiar with them, the community says these are the questions that are the highest priority for the science community. And then NASA puts out calls to say, okay, we're going to we're thinking of having a mission to investigate this question. Send in your proposals.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
Are there? Okay. Yep. Cool.
Oh,
awesome.
Yeah, it was fun.
And for those, even though we're not going to observe tonight, if anybody is interested in seeing the telescopes, let me know and I'll escort you down to the building and show you around briefly. But otherwise, have a good evening. Again, reminder, next month is going to be virtual only. We're going to be on Zoom only because I am not going to be here to let you in. I'm going to be in the warm Caribbean. Enjoying, I'll be in tank top and it'll be nice and warm, drinking my lime into coconuts.
Oh, awesome.
So I will miss next month. Well, I won't miss it. I'll be running it, but it'll be on Zoom. Don't come here. It's going to be empty. The gate will be closed. I will still set up the Zoom, but I'll coordinate with Guy and some other people to have a backup. In case something happens to me, but I've actually run a whole bunch of Zooms from down in St. Croix, like all during COVID.
We don't have a lot to start with, but if we find something, that would be
wonderful. Okay. Let me stop the recording.
I assume probably not, but do you ever work with any lawyers at APL or not?
Thank you, Elizabeth. That was very good.
Yeah, I